for Friday, March the 9th. We are going to take the agenda in the order in which it's printed, that is, public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bills 189, then Senate Bill 260, then work session on 2562, and then public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 258. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 189.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 189 comes to you from the Department of Corrections. States that the primary objective of the Department of Corrections education system is adult basic skill development rather than just functional literacy. It requires the department to test inmates of basic reading and mathematical skills and English language proficiency for individuals with limited English language proficiency, and to run educational programs that allow inmates to improve their basic educational skills. Allows the department to exclude inmates from the educational program for security or health reasons, abolishes the Corrections Educational Advisory Committee, declares an emergency effective upon passage.
We have one witness signed up, Nicole Brown from the Oregon Department of Corrections. Ms. Brown?
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. I am Nicole Brown, Workforce Development Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide information on Senate Bill 189, which was pre-session filed by the governor, by Governor Kulongoski, at the request of the department. This bill will revise obsolete provisions of statutes that affect the delivery of education programs to inmates in three ways. The first is to abolish a defunct committee. Our current statute requires a Corrections Education Advisory Committee for our functional literacy program. This committee was relevant to the initial planning and design of the program, but is no longer needed. The program has been planned, designed, and fully implemented, and has formal and informal processes to guide, place, monitor, and advise program improvement and current and curriculum changes as needed. The second is to establish GED as a desired minimum level of education. When feasible, the department provides GED programs for inmates who do not have a high school diploma, better preparing them for successful transition upon release. Current statute does not clearly include that progress toward a completion of a GED is within the scope of the education program. The third is to authorize flexibility in hours of education and literacy testing method. Statute is prescriptive about when classes are offered, requiring 1.5 hours of education 5 days a week for those in education programs. Oregon Department of Corrections' current practice provides classes in conjunction with Measure 17 inmate work requirements and other program needs, but not necessarily on the time schedule prescribed in statute. Further, current statute specifies a particular literacy test. Proposed changes will allow the department to use the approved test of Adult Basic Skills Program of the Community Colleges and Workforce Development System. These requested changes reflect current practice and will not affect the number of inmates served in the education program or its cost, because these changes will bring statutes into alignment with best practices for adult education. We respectfully request that you send Senate Bill 189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Brown, we've been here almost over 2 months. I'd like to compliment you and Mr. and Director Williams for your concise and brief presentation.
Thank you.
It is appreciated this morning.
Mr. Chair, you were on the meth task work group, and one of the first things we learned, and we continue to have it reinforced almost everywhere we're looking in this building that deals with inmates, if they come out and they don't have a job, they don't have housing, the recidivism rates go up. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at the first paragraph on the second page. Proposed changes, approved test of adult basic skills programs. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And is there anything that you're doing or that we need to do to provide a better opportunity to get these people the skills they need to hold a job when they come out of there?
Sarah McPherson, Representative Krieger. At this point, the Department of Corrections has changed its... We've changed some of the assessment tools that we're using in our corrections education program, and we'd like the statute to reflect those changes. I can't speak today necessarily to the educational continuum, except that the department is pursuing efforts to deal with workplace certifications, other kinds of employability programming for inmates in our custody. So educational programming beyond the GED, yes, the department is absolutely supportive of educational programming and workplace essentials past the GED. We have vocational training or work-based education programs, and there's always future budget opportunities that we will look to expand those programs. So in terms of this particular statute, we really would like to clean it up and make the GED at this point that minimum level of basic education that we offer. However, the department's obligations to serve inmates beyond the GED, we are aware of that obligation and we do have programs. However, there aren't any that are proposed as a part of this particular statutory change.
Representative Barker, did you have a question?
I didn't. I got an answer. Thank you.
Very good. Ms. Brown, what proportion of the inmates in the Department of Corrections have a high school or higher education now?
Well, in current reality, for the inmate population profile of admits to the department in 2005, 19% come into our custody with a high school diploma, 2% come in with post-secondary, 32% come in with a GED. We should be mindful that inmates who come into our custody with a credential don't always have the essential skills to be functional in society. So I will further detail that statistic by saying 5% of our inmates come in with a credential and they read below the eighth grade level. Now, if you want to know the number that we're looking at in terms of those admits in 2005, the number that we look at, because we look at inmates who have a minimum of 1 year remaining on their sentence, so we narrow our statistics there, because we do receive inmates in our custody who, because of time served in the county, do not they have less than 1 year remaining on their sentence. That is to say that the inmates, the admissions to the department that we look at and the number that defines those statistics is 3,751 inmates.
Okay. This may be more detailed than you have readily at hand, but I'd be curious. Are the inmates who come in with a high school diploma, are they, how do they compare to the skills of those who have a GED? That is one or the other a better credential in terms of predicting their work skills and how successful they're going to be?
Well, if we think about it in the national context, the GED test is normed with high school students across the country. So I cannot speak specifically to Oregon, but when you look at the norming process for the GED and the length of time it takes for the new GED to come out in 2000, for example, it didn't come out until 2002 because of the importance of that norming process and delivering that assessment to high school students across the country, it is to be a comparable credential. We have not done any comparisons, and I'm not so sure that I could provide that data, but we have not done those comparisons for the inmates in our custody.
Comment, Chair.
Representative Kahn.
You asked a very good question. The professionals in the field of education don't even have that information, much less the corrections department. And just to kind of keep it in also perspective, an eighth grade readability level is not bad. The average American is between fifth and sixth grade readability.
We have to run some expertise here in our committee.
I wonder where we are as legislators.
I won't comment on that one.
Are there any further questions for Ms. Brown? Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. Brown.
Chair McPherson, thank you, and the members of the subcommittee, thank you.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 189 and open a work session on Senate Bill 189. Committee members, it looks like this is this is mainly a housekeeping here, although I think one policy choice, I think that's the clearest policy choice, is to establish the GED as the minimum level of education. And that's one of the reasons why I asked that question, is just to get a sense about how important that credential is.
They said they can do that at no cost, which is good. No additional cost. I was going to ask about the financial.
Right, and we have no fiscal impact here reported on this bill.
Well, and also, Chair, that as our witness stated, the GED is going through rigorous standards adjustments and changes, so I would hate that anybody thinks that this is a minimal amount of skills, because it is, it's being much more... A highly respected tool in the field.
That's good. Well, and one of the things I might suspect, not having any particular information on this myself, not being an educator, but that it perhaps a person who pursues a GED, that might be a better credential than maybe a high school diploma is for somebody who is just biding time,
right?
Completing seat time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an important credential.
Well, until the educational world does go to proficiencies rather than seat time, this is very comparable.
Right. Okay. Do I hear a motion?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the committee pass to the floor SB 189. With a recommended due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye. Excused.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Senate Bill 189 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think because of the policy statement around GEDs, I was wondering, Representative Comp, if you'd be willing to carry this bill.
I'd love to carry it.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Okay, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 189 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 260.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 260 comes to you from the Oregon Advocacy Center. It was pre-session filed by the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. This bill allows a guardian to withhold food and water from a person under the guardian's protection under certain limited circumstances. The person prior to capacity clearly stated that he or she would have refused artificial administration of food and water. Administration of food and water is not medically feasible. It would cause severe pain. The person has designated another person to make the health care decision or advanced health care directive regarding administration of food and water. The person does not have appointed health care representative, and the person is permanently unconscious. The person does not have an appointed health care representative or advanced health care directive, but the person is incapable and terminally ill. The person has a progressive fatal illness in advanced stages, unable to communicate, unable to swallow food or water safely, care for oneself or recognize his or her own family, and is very unlikely the person will substantially improve, requires a guardian first to obtain medical information, confirmation of a medical condition that would allow the withholding of food and water from a person under the protection of the guardian. Applies to guardians commenced before, on, or after the effective date of this measure.
We have several witnesses signed up. The first is Bob Junduff from the Oregon Advocacy Center. Mr. Junduff.
Good
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. This bill comes to you today to resolve what's an ambiguity between two areas of Oregon law, and one has to do with the guardianship statute, and one has to do with the statutes that this body created for advanced directives in health care. Back in the 90s, the legislature saw fit to create a whole body of law having to do with advanced directives and governing end-of-life decision-making for Oregonians. 2 years later, it also completely revised the guardianship statutes and rewrote the guardianship statutes. In terms of the advanced directive statute, the basic policy that, you know, one of the basic policies that this body was trying to promote was individual decision making, so that people could make their own decisions about what would happen should they be in an end of life situation, and to encourage people to plan ahead for that eventuality. For those who did not do that, who did not plan ahead, where it was unclear what their intentions were, certain protections were put into place. And there were specific protections put into place for the with the situation in which there had to be a decision made about the withholding or approval of artificial nutrition, hydration, tube feeding, and water. And in that case, there was a presumption in law that individuals consent to tube feeding unless there's some indication that would override that, or there are other very limited exceptions in law. When the guardianship statute was rewritten 2 years later, for the first time there was a referral in the guardianship law over to the advanced directive law in terms of medical coverage. In the course of doing that, it raised some question about what authority guardians have when they are in a that's a court-appointed guardian has, when they're in a situation in which they have been empowered to make health care decisions for an individual, and we're in a situation where the question of whether to agree to or withhold artificial nutrition and hydration arises. Due to some ambiguity in that law, right now it appears that a guardian not only has complete authority to withhold artificial nutrition and hydration at any time, but also has complete protection from liability for doing so. What this bill would do would clarify that a guardian, like other surrogate health care decision makers, has a certain limitations upon their authority. And those are the limitations that apply to every other health care decision maker. Every other health care decision maker, I might add, other than the individual themselves making decisions about themselves, that is unaffected by this bill. And it really is designed to address, how these matters came to us is to a series of cases involving people with severe disabilities who had lifetime guardians, and decisions arose about whether to withhold or withdraw artificial nutrition, hydration, and everyone involved agreed that the standards were murky and unclear. And what we're trying to do here is to clarify them so as to protect those particular individuals when this type of situation arises.
Thank you, Ms. Jinda. I need a little more of a primer here, I think, to understand this area of activity. I see that there is a broader category, healthcare representative, and a guardian is one form of healthcare representative. But I think it might be helpful for me and for the other committee members to understand the circumstances in which a guardian is appointed, who else would be a healthcare representative, how these the scope of authority of guardians as compared to other healthcare representatives compares looking back in time.
Mr. Chair, fundamentally there are two types of healthcare representatives. One type is an individual who's been appointed by the individual themselves. We'll call that individual the principal. When you sign a healthcare directive or a power of attorney for healthcare decision making, you can appoint somebody else to make decisions for you, a loved one, someone you trust, someone who you can impart your wishes in terms of how you wish to be treated in the future should you become incapacitated. The other type of health care representative is one that is appointed by the court through the guardianship procedures. In those situations, normally a person has become incapacitated and has not designated someone to act on their behalf, and so a court will intervene upon the petition of someone else and appoint a person to make decisions for that individual. The court-appointed guardian may be granted the power to make health care decisions, specifically included within the category of health care decisions is the authority to make decisions about withdrawal or approval of artificial nutrition and hydration. In terms of the fact that we have two types of representatives, one type should have specific direction from the individual and be the person who is empowered by that individual to make decisions. In the court-appointed situation, that will be someone that the court has decided should act and make those decisions for the person. And they will normally be acting without the direction of the protected person. One other wrinkle, and I know this gets complicated, is that a person may be appointed a guardian and also have a health care directive. That can happen. In those situations, the law specifically says that the health care directive should prevail in terms of health care decision making.
Why would there be a guardian appointed? Because of other functions other than making health care decisions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Guardians have a variety of powers. They have the power not only to make health care decisions, but to make placement decisions. In other words, decide where an individual lives. So a common situation is which a guardian may be appointed and then make a decision for an elderly parent to place them in a care facility. They also get to make decisions about the use of immediate monies that the individual receives, and to make decisions about the person's care so that they're protected from harm and in a comfortable situation. There's other minor powers that also are associated with a full guardianship.
How would you characterize the changes that are made by this bill with respect to the authority of a guardian? Is it limiting the power of the guardian over the withholding of nutrition and hydration? Is it expanding it, or is it clarifying it? Is it neutral as to a change from existing law?
My analysis, Mr. Chair, is that it's doing two things. It's clarifying it because it is ambiguous right now. But my reading of the law and our organization's reading of the law is that right now the effect of this bill would be to narrow it, that authority, and bring it within the same categories and standards that apply to all other healthcare decision makers. Our analysis of how the laws interact right now are that inadvertently guardians have much wider powers than any other decision maker in this particular area. There is some ambiguity there, and there's been a lot of discussion in the elder law world about whether it's broader or not broader. But I think a fair reading of the statutes, when you read them together, is that guardians actually have broader power than any other healthcare decision maker now. And this would clarify that their decision-making power is consistent with other healthcare representatives.
Councilor Taylor.
Chairman of the Committee, Mr. Judith, I take it the one thing it definitely clarifies is that a guardian can only make the decision to withhold food and water after medical confirmation of the condition of the person that's being withheld from?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, that's correct. And that medical confirmation would basically be that a person is in a has a terminal condition and may die within 6 months, or a doctor would say is likely to die within 6 months, or in the other situations enumerated in the statute.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also trying to figure out how this is designed to work, and I was trying to read between the lines here and figure out why this is necessary. So if there's a guardian now and no advance directive, what power, how does the guardian make the decision about withholding the tube feeding? Right now, where do they go to look? Do they just have general power, or do they, what factors are they considering, and what guidelines do they follow in making that decision without this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, in normal circumstances where this issue will arise, a individual patient will be in medical care, and the guardian, as the medical care decision maker, will consult with a physician. And as in all medical decisions, normally there needs to be a agreement between the two parties in order to take any action. So in the example of tube feeding, a physician would ask the medical decision maker, that in this case the guardian, I think tube feeding is appropriate in this situation, would you consent to that action? And the guardian, in consultation with the physician, would then either give or withhold consent for that decision.
Yeah, I was looking for that. Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Representative Wisner.
This is a very complicated. Yes. Now we're going, I'm a retired military officer, and I'm going from being a lawyer to a medical doctor, and it's not easy to. I did have some judicial experience in the military, but I've had very little medical experience. I mean, this is really your conditions. You talk about, you know, number A there is, you know, specifically stated, so it doesn't have to be in writing. We're gonna have to determine if the person, you know, said it to a friend or however. That's pretty ambiguous. That's not. We're looking at. I'm assuming the purpose here is to protect you from liability. That doesn't seem, that seems like a lawyer could justify a lot of hours arguing that. And also, I don't understand, as a non-medical person, how it's medically, it's not medically feasible or would cause severe and lasting, intractable and long-lasting pain to administer it. I don't, you know, can you enlighten us a little bit on this, sir?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I'd like to say two things on that score. And one is that those particular standards are ones that we've had for everyone in Oregon for the past 16 years. But also, next up on the witness list is Dr. Tina Kitchen, and you'd probably be better off asking a medical doctor those questions than me.
I appreciate that response.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair. Explicit in wills and trusts, there's directives on your health care. What effect is this going to have on those, and would they have to be some way adjusted to conform?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, this bill should not affect in any way an advance directive written under Oregon law or directives in a will. This strictly affects the guardianship law and the standards governing court-appointed guardians.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
That answered mine.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jindal. Next, we have signed up Bill Lynch.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Bill Lynch, and I'm here representing the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. The coalition is made up of more than 25 organizations that represent people with developmental disabilities, families, providers, advocates, and others. and we're here in support of SB 260. Individuals with disabilities are too often reminded that they are considered second-class citizens by many people. Within the last short period of time, we saw a story in the press about medical treatments performed on a Seattle child with disabilities to permanently limit her growth and physical development for the convenience of the family caregiver. And even more recently, here in Oregon, an elected Education Service District board member made disparaging remarks about children with disabilities served in his program. And on a regular basis, service providers in the developmental disabilities community report that some physicians fail to provide adequate and appropriate medical care to people with disabilities. It's in this context of devaluing, dismissive, discriminatory behavior that we support this bill. In recent years in Oregon, several situations have raised concerns about the power of a guardian to withhold or withdraw nutrition and hydration from protected persons. We believe people with disabilities should have the same protections in this regard as any other person. And we believe this legislation will assure the rights of protected persons and provide a legal process for guardians who are confronted with making these very serious decisions. We support passage of this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lynch, could you clarify your conclusion that because individuals with disabilities are subject to devaluing or discriminating mm-hmm. comments, you support this bill, which says that their hydration and nutrition can be withheld?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, yes. It's unfortunately, people with disabilities are stigmatized, stereotyped, still to a large degree. They're devalued, and there are circumstances where a guardian can be subject to that same sort of devaluing mentality when it comes to people with disabilities, that the life of a person with developmental disabilities or any other disability might be somewhat less worthy, less valued than the life of an able-bodied person. If decisions are made in that context, it can often lead to negative consequences for the individual. Does that answer your question, sir?
I'm sorry. Thank you for the opportunity to follow up. It really doesn't. So because they're subject to this framework of potential discrimination or defamation, then what you're suggesting is that guardians should be able to say withhold their nutrition and hydration and potentially then terminating their life to protect them from this type of discrimination?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, let me clarify. Actually, what I'm saying is that those decisions that the guardian makes could be influenced by a notion that the life of the person is of less value than the life of an able-bodied person, so that hydration or nutrition might be withdrawn in a situation where if that person had been able-bodied or of full cognitive power, the same decision wouldn't be made. So we're saying that we're afraid that discrimination would take place in the process of making a decision to withdraw hydration or nutrition.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lynch, I hope you'll clarify this for me, because it's my understanding that this bill does not expand the opportunities for guardians to withhold nutrition. What it does is says that you can only withhold nutrition in these certain circumstances if you've met these certain tests that are in the statute.
Correct.
So it doesn't expand the opportunities to withhold nutrition. It says you can only withhold nutrition if you met these tests. Am I understanding that correct?
Chair McPherson, Representative, that is my understanding.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Lynch? Would you like that right now?
After you're done.
Okay, very good. Mr. Lynch, then we'll excuse you and invite Tina Kitchen forward.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, I'm Tina Kitchen. I am the medical director for the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. I'd like to start off with just a wee bit of my perception of history, having sat through hours and hours and hours of hearings around the Oregon Healthcare Decisions Act back in the mid-90s. At that time, after fairly extensive process, it actually set up that there were people who needed extra protection under the law, and they were looking at people who may have food and nutrition withheld and withdrawn, and said that essentially the only people who could decide that was the person themselves or a healthcare representative appointed by the person and given that authority, and then set up some exemptions to the presumption, namely that you were in an active dying process, you were permanently comatose, at an end-stage Alzheimer's-like condition, which medically feeding tubes at that point don't prolong your life. It just increases pain and suffering. And then what I would consider as a physician to be sort of a throwaway category, interminable pain, but was meant to sort of capture those very, very unique situations where the actual act of doing a feeding tube may cause more problems than it was worth. After that was passed into law, they did a cleanup of the guardianship law, which said, oh, by the way, guardianship should be allowed to make healthcare decisions, and we've now got new terminology, a healthcare representative. And my understanding with that cleanup made guardians healthcare representatives, which then also gave them full power to withhold and withdraw the feeding tubes. They did not make them subject to those presumptions and then that exception process to that presumption of consent. And this bill would clean up the cleanup to make it clear that state policy is that there should only be withholding, withdrawing under certain circumstances, one of which is you yourself have decided that that's what you want with your life, and you've taken the steps to make sure that that happens. You've appointed your healthcare representative, and you've given them that authority. Or you've done an advance directive and said, under those circumstances, I don't want the feeding tube. Or you then get to that end stage of your life where feeding tube is not going to really be a benefit for you, and then you should not be forced to have a feeding tube. So we have been involved in some of these situations. There have been fortunately few and far between with Oregon Advocacy Center where there's been questions about the guardian's right to withhold or withdraw a feeding tube under circumstances where medically it would appear that the person would benefit from the feeding tube. And that's why we do support this clarification under law. And we do recommend that you pass this bill.
Thank you, Dr. Kitchen. The circumstances, you mentioned some very difficult, upsetting situations. Put a sort of a human face on this. Is it a family member who's decided that it's a decision should be made to withhold nutrition?
Chairman Pearson, actually, yes. In both of the situations that come readily to mind, it was a family member who was a guardian, and I would think lots of different reasons, had decided that a feeding tube was not appropriate.
Mr. Barker.
If Terry Schiavo lived in Oregon, what difference would this bill have made, or would it have made any difference?
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, this bill would not make any difference to current or state law because Terry Schiavo was permanently comatose. And so she would meet those presumptions.
Chair.
The exceptions to the presumptions.
Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. This is not necessarily for good doctor here, but I don't know why I was blessed to be in many unique situations, but I ended up basically, well, I did. I made the final decision for my father-in-law, and this was 20-some years ago, and I was so uncomfortable with it because he had asked, the doctor had asked all the family members, and nobody could make the decision, and the father-in-law says, well, let Betty do it. She's like, oh, no.
Why me? Huh?
Yeah, and so I appreciate the depth of about the presumptions and what this means and how it can be and should be applied. So I deeply appreciate this coming to us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Kitchen, can you please confirm for me that I want to make sure I'm understanding why we're faced with this bill, that we are not expanding the situations where guardians can withhold feeding. In fact, we're clarifying that guardians can withhold feeding and nutrition only in certain circumstances. Is that correct?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, absolutely it is correct. Currently, it may be under state law, depending upon your interpretation, sure, that guardians have full authority to withhold and withdraw feeding tubes, and now they're saying that they must be within these conditions to be able to have that authority.
Any further questions? Dr. Kitchen, or
excuse me,
Representative Wisnett.
I'm not sure. Thank you, Doctor, for your testimony. I'm not sure. I read your testimony about the feeding tube. How my question earlier about how that's is not possible or. Can you explain, to a non-medical person, how could a not medically feasible to provide the feeding, the water, the food? The Minister of Assisted Nutrition or hydration is not medically feasible or would cause severe harm.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, that is the category that I have most trouble with as a physician, because I think it would be extremely unique circumstances that would be true. However, I have knowledge of at least a couple people with very, very significant disabilities whose central nervous system disability appears to have affected their ability for their bowels to work in a coordinated fashion. Which essentially means that even with food in there that is administered through a feeding tube, the body can't deal with it and absorb it, and essentially they start throwing up and they get sicker as you try to feed them. I think that would be one of the very few unique circumstances where that condition may apply.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then we'll excuse Dr. Kitchen. There are no further witnesses, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 260. Proceeding through our agenda, open a work session on House Bill 2562. Council Stanford will shovel forward. Remind us what's going on with this bill.
I wasn't really having fun around it.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2562 relates to refusal to submit to blood or urine tests under Oregon's implied consent law. Briefly summarizing what the bill does, under Oregon's implied consent law, every person who operates a motor vehicle on a public roadway is expected to consent to chemical testing that can determine whether the person is driving under the influence of intoxicants. The amount and type of intoxicants in a person's body can be measured using breath, blood, and urine tests. Breath or blood test must be used if the intoxicant is alcohol. A urine test must be used if the intoxicant is a controlled substance or inhalant. Currently, a person who refuses to take a breath test is subject to a fine of at least $500, but not more than $1,000. A person who refuses to take a blood or urine test, however, is not subject to a fine. House Bill 2562 makes all refusals under implied consent subject to fine.
Council, let me just refresh my memory. So if a driver is stopped and suspected of being in under the influence of alcohol and refuses a breath test, then they're already subject to this fine of $500 to $1,000.
Correct.
If they would there be any circumstance in which they would be asked to consent to a urine for if it's suspected alcohol urine or blood test in lieu of or in addition to a breath test.
Let me clarify. Thank you, Chairman Pearson. Let me clarify one thing first. My answer, yes, previously, the person must be under arrest first, of course. So there needs to be probable cause to suspect that they're driving under the influence. And then they would be subject to the $500 to $1,000 fine for refusing to take a breath test. In terms of blood or urine, there are persons up here that could probably testify better, Representatives Krieger and Barker, but from my knowledge, the way that the blood test generally works, it would generally come about in one of two ways. There was an accident, and perhaps I've actually seen this on a ride-along that I did, where both the victim and the future defendant were in the hospital as a result of the accident, and the person really wasn't in a position to consent to a breath test there. Blood test was the only way to determine the amount of alcohol in the person as a result of the accident there and them not being able to verbalize in some ways their consent. That's one mechanism. There is also, if for a blood test, if a person, if I'm arrested for DUI and I take a breath test and I fail the breath test, Oregon law gives me the ability to say, I don't like those results. I'm requesting an additional test that I have to pay for myself. But I can request an additional test, and that test can be would typically, I think, be by a blood draw. So those are the two mechanisms that the blood comes in. Urine comes in the context of controlled substance DUIs. Controlled substance DUI meaning you're high from some kind of drug, not alcohol. Sometimes basically you can charge DUIs in three ways: alcohol, drugs, or combo. You've got a combination of both. And so what would generally happen, this is kind of I'll summarize it as much as possible, but if there is a driver that is all over the road or doing whatever and the officer responds and doesn't pick up on any kind of smell of alcohol but can note something's going on with this person, there are different signs of a person being under the influence of controlled substances. Oregon law has what are called drug recognition evaluators, officers with specified training in recognizing persons under the influence of controlled substances. The officer responding to the scene would note, it's not alcohol that's messing this person up, it's something else, would call a DRE to the scene. That's the drug recognition evaluator. The DRE then would proceed through what Oregon has set up as this 12-part process to determine what category of drug the person is under the influence of. A breath test is actually one of those steps. You still ask them to take a breath test, and it's oftentimes a .00 that it shows up as. The 12th step in the 12-step process for controlled substances is the request for a urine test. And so that's when a urine test, those are the only circumstances that I'm aware of that a urine test is going to come up, is in the context of a controlled substance DUI, or I guess a combo DUI also. Anything?
Representative Bonamici?
I just have a follow-up question about the blood test issue, because when you were talking about the people in the hospital and you said that they couldn't consent to a breath test because they're in the hospital and are obviously injured, how can they consent to a blood test if they can't consent to a breath test?
Derek, well, one thing is they don't have the intoxilizer. I guess I misspoke. I think you're assuming the situation from what I described that the person literally can't speak or do
right.
anything. Is there? Oregon doesn't have mobile intoxilizers at this point. Intoxilizer is the machine that does the breath test. Some states have it where you can take it out in the field, and some states have it where you can actually give it at the scene. There's a preliminary test that you can do. Oregon doesn't have that. It's at the station. Those are where the intoxilizer 5000s are. The person is not going to be at the station because they're in the hospital. So they can't go down to the station to consent. The only way is through a blood draw at the hospital.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Council, I think it would be good to refresh us on the implied consent law here in Oregon, where it says that if a person is who has an Oregon driver's license gives implied consent to a breath, blood, or urine test if the person is arrested. And this purpose of this bill was to bring the blood and urine test in line with the breath test. Is that not correct?
That's correct. Regard to the fine specifically.
With regard to the fine specifically.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've thought about this bill a bit because We heard the stories about the seriousness of what happens with driving under the influence, and believe me, I appreciate the seriousness of it from the people from the Eugene Symphony, and we heard the stories about that, and I'm extremely concerned about that. And I do understand the implied consent law. The thing that I'm concerned about is that this is addressing the refusal to take the tests. And I truly hope that this bill will encourage people who should be taking the test to take the test. But I'm a little bit concerned that it's another club that isn't going to necessarily change the ultimate result. That if somebody already faces a suspension of the driver's license for the refusal, then is that person going to say, oh, well, I know I'm going to risk losing my driver's license, or that I'm going to risk this one-year suspension for refusing, but because you're threatening with additional fine, therefore I won't refuse. I'm a little bit concerned about that, because I think our ultimate goal here is to address the seriousness of driving under the influence. Whether this is the right tool or not, I mean, I'm going to support the bill. I just want to make sure that we're not thinking that this is going to help when I'm not sure that it's going to. It's going to be an additional fine, and as Ms. Alconich testified, that means less money for treatment and restitution. But hopefully, we'll rely on the experts who say that this is a good thing. Hopefully, having that additional club to hang over people to say, you know, you shouldn't be refusing because you're going to be facing this fine, hopefully that'll help. I hope that it does what it's intended to do, and I question whether an additional fine is going to make somebody submit to a test that they were ordered or their understanding that they have some reason to refuse anyway. And I do appreciate, and I know Ms. Meyer talked about the additional levels of intrusiveness with blood or blood tests or your analysis tests, and I know that the implied consent law says we give up those rights when we drive. So I appreciate that. I just wanted to make sure that we're getting at the true problem, which is driving under the influence. If an additional fine helps, I sure hope so. But if it doesn't, let's keep looking for real solutions to the serious problem of driving under the influence.
Any further discussion?
I'll just say briefly, I think this will help in what it's really intends to put additional pressure on somebody to take the test, especially the second time they're caught. Is the first time, it was my experience, first time you had somebody, if they called an attorney, they tell them go ahead and take the test, because you could get diversion if it was their first time and it wasn't as serious. After that time, they'll tell them refuse the test. And then we'll at least have a better shot at beating it in court. Not that they weren't drunk, but, and so this hopefully will encourage people with a threat of the fine to go ahead and take the test and to help in the prosecution. I mean, I think, and we need that especially for repeat offenders, because they're the really dangerous ones who are out there killing, doing a lot of the killing.
Good point.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
I would just go back to a discussion we had on another bill at one point, and if we recollect that we see clicker ticket signs all along the freeways and our streets, and that fine for not buckling up has increased, and I think that it has had the intended effect of getting more people to use their seatbelts, myself included. So I think that there is some leverage to be had by using this type of tool, and I think we heard that from the Oregon State Police witness that we had as well.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I just one comment that might be useful, Representative Bonamici, is that I can put on a prosecutor hat for a second. The refusal cases, refusal Dewey cases that are tried a lot in Oregon, prosecutors are allowed to argue the person refused to take the test. What do you think that means, folks, to the jury? And with it's kind of an additional quiver or arrow in the quiver, I should say, right now for a for an alcohol Dewey, if the person refuses, the prosecutor can get up and say they were told they were faced with a suspension if they were going to refuse the test, and they went ahead and refused it. They were going to face a $500 or $1,000 fine, and they went ahead and refused it. Why do you think that is? And you can't make that second argument at all with the controlled substances at this point about the facing the fine also. It doesn't answer your question at all, but I think in some ways is an additional point that could be made in refusal prosecutions, that this is another consequence that they were facing and ignored. Why do you think that they ignored it? But that's the only thing I was going to add to that.
I think maybe if there's further discussion, we may be ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2562 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2562 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Cox. Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnick?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye.
House Bill 2562 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Flores, would you like to carry that?
I would be honored to. However, since this is Representative Barker's bill,
I beg your pardon. Would you like to carry it, Representative Barker? thank you for pointing that out to me, Representative Flores. I missed that for the moment. Yeah, thank you. I will close the work session on House Bill 2562 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 258. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. Senate Bill 258 relates to the Blakely case, which I'll explain further. In criminal prosecutions, the state sometimes alleges enhancement factors in order to enhance the potential sentence if a defendant is convicted. Examples of such enhancement factors include defendant can't be rehabilitated, defendant acted with deliberate cruelty. There are many others. In the 2004 case of Blakely versus Washington, the United States Supreme Court held that under the Sixth Amendment's right to a jury trial, a defendant must have the opportunity to have a jury decide such enhancement factors. The 2005 Oregon legislature responded to this Blakely case by reforming Oregon's sentencing enhancement law. In short, what it did is it set up procedures by which the state could allege enhancement facts, and the defendant then could elect to have a jury decide those facts or the court decide such facts. Senate Bill 258 addresses these sentence enhancement provisions. The first thing it does is it repeals Section 20, Chapter 463 of Oregon Laws 2005. That's the section that called for the repeal of the sentencing enhancement provisions on January 2nd, 2008. So it effectively does away with the sunset clause. The provisions thus become permanent. Senate Bill 258 also amends ORS 40.015 to state that Oregon's evidence code applies to sentencing enhancement trials. It expressly states that alternate jurors may be utilized in enhancement trials. And finally, it identifies July 7th, 2005 as the relevant date for considering what actions are subject to the enhancement provisions.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Fuster and Mr. Prinz are signed up. Why don't you both come forward, gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Craig Prinz. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. Just wanted to, I think Mr. Stanford pretty much said everything, and Mr. Fuster and I just wanted to be here for any questions. So I really have nothing much to add. I mean, that was a great rundown of what the bill does. It's basically just putting into permanent law what we did last session in light of the Blakely case.
Mr. Prinz, I think we're not going to let you off quite that easily, because there, while some of us were immersed in this issue last session, I think for probably some members of the committee, the Blakely case doesn't mean very much. So I think we need to kind of go back and walk people through, and we've heard a kind of quick once over from counsel, but I think we need to walk through a little bit more.
I'll do that, and Mr. Fuster is actually, I'll give the background of the Blakely case. So I brought some grids. Remember the grids? This is the way felons are sentenced in Oregon. This is called the sentencing guidelines. We have what's called a mandatory guideline system. That means that the judge finds where an offender fits, what box he or she fits in this group of about 100 blocks, based upon the seriousness level of the crime and the criminal history of the offender. And that is the presumptive sentence. Whatever that box says is the presumptive sentence. And the judge can only go up based upon aggravating factors. In a the Blakely case means that if the judge is going to go up, those aggravating factors are like elements of the crime almost. They have to be proven to the jury. And so in 05, we had a decision to make, which was, what are we going to do with felony sentencing in light of the Blakely case? And we studied several options. One of the options would have been to make our guidelines discretionary guidelines. That's what the federal guidelines became. That would mean that it would mean that these boxes are advisory or discretionary. If the judge decided to do a longer sentence, that would be lawful. But and so that, under the Blakely cases, does not require a jury finding. We looked at expanding the blocks, meaning having a box that would have range within it, so that the judge would still be making a discretionary decision. And we looked at that, and we looked at the pros and cons of that. And what we settled on was Senate Bill 528, which is what we call the Blakely fix. And the Blakely fix keeps our mandatory guidelines, which means that if the judge decided not to follow the presumptive sentence, there has to be a lawful basis, which is subject to appellate review. And so we decided to keep that system, and we realized to keep that system, we had to have a statutory way for the jury to decide those enhancement facts, especially in those situations where the enhancement facts relate to the offender. Meaning, I think the way that 528 expresses it, there's enhancement facts that are basically offense-related that would come up in trial normally. And then there's enhancement facts that are about the offender that might be prejudicial for the jury to hear when they're hearing about, for example, say some of the classic ones are, say that the defendant has had some type of prior involvement that is an enhancement factor or an aggravating factor. Or that this crime had a bigger harm or loss than usual. To avoid prejudicing the jury that's deciding the guilt or innocence, the Blakely fix basically allowed lawyers use the word bifurcated, which I've never heard in any other, a bifurcated process where, just like in a murder case, you'd have a sentencing phase, or excuse me, a guilt or innocent phase and then a sentencing phase. So it allows for the guilt or innocence to be decided, and if it's on those issues that might be prejudicial, that would be decided, and then there'd be a second part that would be the enhancement facts. When we put this together, we had the Blakely Advisory Work Group, and we were worried about basically, is this going to mean a lot more? Is this going to mean a lot more court time? Is this going to be a lot more? Are we going to have a lot of those bifurcated cases? I think the answer is that we really haven't seen a big amount of those. The lawyers, I think, have become used to this. They plead the factors into the, they either give notice or they plead the factors into the indictment. And so I think that's why we're here. It seems to have worked pretty efficiently. And this bill, as Mr. Stanford says, makes it permanent. And then it makes just some, I think I would describe them as some technical fixes where there was language, that says things like the court shall find. Well, now the jury's going to be finding those, so you'll see some of that language is gone. And that's really the best, the background, the best I can do. And if there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. So thank you,
Mr. Chair. A very simple question. Are enhancement factors used interchangeably with aggravation factors? Same thing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Reed, I think the answer is yes, with a but. There are other situations outside of the aggravating factors that, and Mr. Fussner could tell you about it, that may be things that would make a person have a longer sentence. We wanted to make sure that as this case settles out, there's a lot of litigation about how far does the Blakely case go, that we wanted to make sure that it would apply to any enhancement factor. So, for example, when we were putting this together, there's language about whether a sentence should be consecutive or concurrent for two counts. We wanted to make sure if the court decides that to have a consecutive sentences, that Blakely would impact that. We wanted to have a statutory framework that it could apply to that type of case too. And so that's why. So it encompasses all aggravating factors that are in the guidelines, but is broader than that.
Representative Creature, might help for somebody to have a little bit of background. When Max Williams had left and gone to corrections and I was thrown into judiciary, that was my first meeting. I walked into that room after they'd had about, I think you'd had, 5 or 6 months you'd been playing with this. You've got district attorneys, you've got judges, and you've got every brain in the world in there. For 6 months, they could not come to anything, and Jenny Burdick, Senator Burdick and I were there. And we listened to this for 2 days, and what I told them is, I says, look, you've got to tell us what we need to do based on what the need in the law is to comply with the federal. If you don't, you've got 3 cops, a housewife, a couple of candle makers in the Judiciary Committee, and I'm not certain we're going to get as good a product out of this as what you want. And Judge Barron was looking at me from Coos County, and I think he thought I was serious because that was the next day. They finally said, hey, this is what we need to do. They came to Bill Taylor and the people, and they actually came up with this. But this takes a little while to understand what we're doing. But once you grasp it, it's actually fairly simple. This is good, what we're doing. This needs to be done. We're simply, confirming what we did last session.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thank you. Now we're down to 2 cops and a hamburger flipper. question. On the issue of the sentencing guidelines, and I'm concerned the fact that we're talking about upward sentencings here. Can the judge go down based on what we're talking about here, and in what cases can they do that, and can you describe for us? I'm concerned. I know Measure 11 sentences versus other sentences. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can talk about that if you'd like, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron. First of all, Measure 11 it does not apply to, because Measure 11 applies once the elements of the case are, you know, once someone's guilty of a Measure 11 crime, you don't need any enhancement factors. And so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't impact Measure 11. And it does, the Blakely case does not impact the ability to go down. And, meaning, because the defendant's jury trial right is not impacted if the judge is going down, if you follow me. The defendant's not going to object to that. So it really applies. The Blakely case made it so you couldn't go up, is the way I look at it, with our guidelines, without this framework. And so the ability to depart downward has always been present and has continued to be used in courtrooms in Oregon, and is really not impacted by Blakely or the 258.
So just to follow up, so what you're saying is a judge always has the ability to go down.
Correct.
In these guidelines.
Okay. On the guidelines, Mr. Chair, that's correct. Richard Cameron.
Thank you.
Should we hear from Mr. Fessner then, and we can maybe invite further questions in?
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Fessner. I'm an assistant attorney general in the Oregon Department of Justice, and I was a member of that Blakely work group that, as Representative Krieger pointed out, spent a lot of time and effort trying to sort out what to do about this Blakely decision. And the only thing that I would tell you is that from my perspective, doing the work that I do, I get to see a lot of what goes on in the criminal prosecutions around the state. I have a lot of contact with district attorneys. And the impression that I have is that the Blakely fix bill from 2005, Senate Bill 528, has worked quite well. It, as Mr. Prinz pointed out, I think it was a bit of a surprise over the last 2 years that we've worked under this bill to see that there aren't that many cases that are actually submitted to the jury for jury findings on sentencing. Most cases are disposed of by plea negotiations. Many cases are dealt with by the defendant waiving his right to a jury trial and allowing the court to make these departure findings. And so I think it has folded in pretty well into the criminal justice system. And that's why it seems appropriate at this time to remove the sunset clause and continue this system indefinitely. And the other changes that Senate Bill 258 here accomplishes are what I would call mere technical changes. Clarifies that the evidence code does apply to these sentencing hearings, provides for alternate jurors to be seated, as Mr. Stanford already has run through this. It also clarifies that this procedure can be used for imposing dangerous offender sentences and sexually violent dangerous offender sentences, which are two types of additional harsher sentences that are very similar to an upward departure within the guidelines, but they fall in a different statutory section, and Blakely applies to them as well. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions that the committee may have.
Mr. Fessner, I recall that one of the issues that was identified when we were working this through 2 years ago was whether the running of sentences either concurrently or consecutively triggered a Blakely kind of analysis. And I can't recall how that was resolved, if at all, in our temporary legislation. Is that resolved either by court decision now, or is it addressed in this bill or in our solution last time?
Chair McPherson, it unfortunately has not yet been definitively resolved by the Oregon Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court. We have quite a number now of cases going through the appellate system, but it's a very time-consuming system, and we still haven't gotten the final word on that. However, what the original Senate Bill 528 in 2005 did to accommodate that possibility is that it referred to these, and this goes back to Representative Reed's question, it referred to the findings that the jury makes as enhancement facts rather than, strictly speaking, departure facts, a departure being a fact you would have to find in order to depart upward on a sentence. But we took the term enhancement fact to mean anything that's constitutionally required to be found by a jury that enhances or increases a sentence. So under the existing statute as it reads now, and would not be changed by this bill, under the existing statute, if the courts were to hold that consecutive sentence findings must be submitted to a jury, they could be submitted to a jury under the system that we have now. So we did think about that possibility.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the July 7th, 2005 date, saying that this will apply to criminal actions commencing on or after July 7th, 2005. And this may be a purely hypothetical question, but just out of curiosity, what if there's a case that commenced after Blakely but before July 7th, 2005?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I think I can respond to that. There was that window. Blakely was decided in 2004, and what was it, about July or so, I think, something like that. And so there was a window between the Blakely decision and when we got statutory authority to submit these cases to a jury. And what prosecutors and the Department of Justice argued, and I think so far successfully, is because the Constitution requires these now to be submitted to a jury, courts have authority to do that even without a statute that authorizes it. Now, I understand, too, that the defense bar takes the position we're entitled to have a jury, but you can't impanel a jury because you don't have any statutory authority to do that. And I think, at least so far, that has not proved to be a problem. And I know that there were some judges who were submitting these factors to juries right after Blakely was decided, even though there was no statutory authority to do it, on the grounds that we have to do it, the Constitution requires it. And that's one of the reasons why I think the Blakely work group did a pretty good job of coming up with a statutory framework to do, within pretty much, as Mr. Prince said, retaining our guideline system, but adding in this jury trial mechanism to comply with the Constitution.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 258. And open a work session on Senate Bill 258. It was a fairly quick explanation of what took a lot of time and discussion 2 years ago, and I think we're benefited by all that work since I think we've got a pretty well-developed product here now. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 258 to the floor to be passed, and I wouldn't even think that could be on the consent calendar. It's a technical fix.
It is. Removing the sunset is a technical matter, unless somebody would like to think it would be useful to re-educate our colleagues on this.
We'll mix them up if we try.
Representative Barker has moved Senate Bill 258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed in the consent calendar. Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Hoff.
Aye.
Representative
Krieger. Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Senate Bill 258 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 258. Colleagues, that concludes our agenda for Friday, March 9th. Thank you for your attendance. We're adjourned.